From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The election of Donald Trump as U.S. president may be an event as transformative as the First World War, the Bolshevik Revolution, the Great Depression, the rise of Adolf Hitler, and the Second World War. Thus is the premise of a Financial Times editorial entitled How the West Might Soon Be Lost by Martin Wolf, the chief economics commentator at the London-based paper. And he says, it's not a good thing. Wolf adds that, quote, this would mark the end of a U.S.-led West as the central force in global affairs. The result would not be a new order. It would be perilous disorder, closed quote. The Financial Times is recognized internationally as one of the authoritative voices of the global elite. Another such organ, the New York Times, has also hammered on the theme that a potential Trump presidency presents an existential threat, although it's been voicing even more ominous tones with respect to a perceived Russian threat. On Thursday, an editorial bearing the byline of the Times editorial board, entitled Vladimir Putin's Outlaw State, opens with the following. Quote, President Vladimir Putin is fast turning Russia into an outlaw nation. As one of the five permanent members of the United Nations Security Council, his country shares a special responsibility to uphold international law. Yet, his behavior in Ukraine and Syria violates not only the rules intended to promote peace instead of conflict, but also common human decency, closed quote. The picture of gloom and doom being painted in the media comes at a time when the U.S. and Russia risk actual conflict in Syria as the world watches. Recent statements from the U.S. State Department include a threat to Russia voiced this past week by State Department spokesperson John Kirby that jihadist terrorists could begin attacking Russian cities. For its part, Russia has pointed out that it is trying to find a political solution to the situation in Syria and that the United States refuses to do so. To parse all of that, we spoke with our political commentator, Professor Tony Montero, from Philadelphia via Skype Friday. Professor Montero, pleasure as always.
Thank you, Don. It's great to be with you again.
Thanks. Regime change for the world. Let's start with that, an interesting quote from a piece that you sent me earlier.
Yes, that's an article by Martin Wolf, the economics editor of the Financial Times and a very influential thinker in the Anglo-American world and probably in the world on matters of the capitalist economy. And he writes this article that appeared, I think, on Monday, entitled How the West Might Soon Be Lost. And it's subtitled, Under a President Trump, Democracy Would Lose Credibility as a Model for Civilized Political Life.
In other words, an existential threat, right? Uh-huh. In other words, he's an existential threat.
What he represents is an existential threat to the West. And as you quoted him, a Trump victory would be regime change for the world. It would mean the collapse of all of the hegemonic institutions, or I should say the institutions of imperial hegemony that the West has built up over the last 70 years. We're talking about NATO. We're talking about the International Monetary Fund, we're talking about the World Bank, we're talking about the World Trade Organization, and we're talking about all of these neoliberal trade agreements, such as NAFTA, such as the Trans-Pacific Partnership, such as the TIPP, such as the European Union and the Eurozone. What Martin Wolf, who was not prone to hyperbole or to broad exaggeration is seeing is something that we, you and I, have talked about consistently over these months, that what Donald Trump represents and what he is saying undermines the entire system of hegemony and of imperial domination of the West, which is grounded in the global economic and military power of the United States. So here we are. And I think, again, as we have said, that most of the left, and all of the liberals, of course, have misunderstood what we're looking at. They see Trump as an unhinged, undisciplined, kind of buffoonish and dangerous misogynist and racist, you know, and some of it is true. I mean, I take the dangerous out. He has a lot of personality characteristics that are obnoxious. But when you get below that and you see precisely what he is saying, Martin Wolf understands what Donald Trump is about more than almost the entire left in this country. Right. But the other thing that is very, very important, and we've talked about this, that Wolf doesn't say it, but it's implied that Donald Trump represents a threat to the war plans and military domination and threats and belligerent stances towards China and Russia. In effect, Donald Trump is representing, if not in a full-blown set of policies, at least in the political stance and statements that he has made consistently, a pullback from empire, a pullback from war, a pullback from neoliberal globalization. And this is where we are, and it explains why almost the entire ruling class is united against him, or as they say, in a single big tent, and Clinton is their representative.
You know, on that point, let's again repeat and maybe amplify what you said before. This is essentially a reliable voice of the elite saying Donald Trump is a threat to that elite. We see it that way.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Oh, yes. And you know, the other thing that Martin Wolf says, and he acknowledges almost, that Donald Trump comes along at a time of a crisis and an impending, even deeper crisis for the neoliberal capitalist organization of the global economy, you know? Right. And he says at one point, if I might just quote, this is Wolf, he says, the U.S. and its allies remain immensely powerful, but their economic dominance is in slow decline. According to the International Monetary Fund, the share of the high-income countries, essentially the U.S. and its chief allies, will fall from 64% of global output in 1990 to 39% in 2020, right, while the U.S. share will fall from 22% to 15% over this period. Right. Well, and so here you have Donald Trump, who is in effect saying and probably mirroring this decline, and he is saying we have to renegotiate our position in the world. And it can't be done, as Trump sees it, through war, regime change, nation building, and especially war which could lead to nuclear war with Russia and China. And it is very interesting. In the last debate, Trump said that, in effect, he rejects this idea that the United States reserves to itself to be the first to use nuclear weapons.
Right.
In other words, he literally pledged a no first strike position if he is the president.
And, you know, it's interesting that, too, because if you look at actual military doctrine, the Soviet Union and Russia both said basically, you know, yeah, we reserve the right to use the first use, which we won't, only under the following conditions. If your troops cross our border, and, you know, in other words, in self-defense, because, you know, we're not going to fight Europe again on our land. You cross the border, we're taking you out. And so you should know that invading us means nuclear war. So don't invade us.
Well, they made that statement. Their military leaders made such a statement about 2 years ago, which is, as you say, a continuation of their doctrine going back to the Soviet Union. They would only use nuclear weapons in an instance of self-defense. And of course, they when they look at the NATO, especially U.S. troops, on their northern borders and carrying out military exercises, and they see the stationing of U.S. military nuclear weapons in Poland and Bulgaria, and they look at what this nuclear modernization will mean in terms of the miniaturization of nuclear weapons, meaning that nuclear weapons will become battlefield weapons. I mean, this is a dangerous time in the world. And again, you know, in terms of these next 40 days or less, and it might not be enough time, the American people have to be awakened to this threat of war. And it is overarching. It is imminent. We are in perhaps a more dangerous time than we've ever been in since the end of World War II. And I include in that the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yep. Yeah, just to contextualize this, and there's a good recitation of it, only upside down, in the New York Times editorial about Putin. We have essentially a condition like this. You have U.S. on one side, Russia on the other, in a hot war in Syria, and essentially a hot war in Ukraine as well that goes on and off. Particularly, you have a U.S. ally shooting down a Russian plane, killing the pilots, and shooting down the takedown of a couple of helicopters by U.S.-backed terrorist groups in Syria. You have the U.S. bombing the Syrian army in coordination now openly. They have radio communications between the U.S. and ISIS that provoked a UN Security Council meeting that the United States said, well, it was an accident. So when Russia called them in to have a conversation at the UN Security Council, Samantha Power walked out saying that this was some kind of a stunt. And then you have the U.S. saying at the UN essentially that Russia, because it's blocking U.S. efforts to get Security Council authorization for a no-fly zone in Syria, and it's actually Russia and China that have been vetoing this, having looked at what that meant to Libya. You know, the rhetoric now coming out of the State Department is that these terrorists that we back are going to be blowing up Russian cities. That's the context.
Yeah. And you're right. This New York Times editorial of yesterday entitled Vladimir Putin's Outlaw State. And this is by the New York Times editorial board. And of course, the New York Times has backed every war of regime change under the Bush and Obama administrations that have occurred. So the New York Times, which is supposedly liberal, is really the newspaper of war and of the hawks. But this editorial is frightening because it says that the government of Russia, which, by the way, only a couple of weeks ago had parliamentary elections and Putin's party, United Russia, increased its majority in the parliament, the lower house. So now they're calling this democratic state illegitimate, in spite of the fact that they have what are called in the West free and fair elections. They have a parliament. They have, in fact, not a two-party system, but a multi-party system.
Right.
And this is called an outlaw regime, an outlaw state. When did we last hear that? And I think this is, again, something that you and I have talked about over the months, that the U.S. is trying to set up conditions for a color revolution in Russia, what we would more accurately call regime change. This editorial is and has to be considered a call to war. And it's interesting that they have kind of stepped up their preparation for war. I was of the opinion that they would wait until after the election. But somehow they're concerned that Hillary could lose the election. I think at this point, if you're betting, you'd have to bet on her winning. But they're very concerned that she could lose, that something could happen, that Assange could, drop some emails that would severely damage her, or that the uprising that has crystallized around Trump could take the day. And therefore, their war plans would be in trouble. It seems that they are pushing them up. We could see a real October surprise, something real bad, especially in Syria. And they might do Syria and the Ukraine simultaneously.
I'm thinking about Robert McNamara and both Fog of War and the contemporaneous recordings of conversations he had with JFK during the Cuban Missile Crisis, about the military leadership not understanding the signaling that was going on back and forth between the U.S. and the USSR, that the placement of this asset and this move by this one and this move by that one was a new kind of language that the world had never seen before. Well, that's 54 years ago, and the world's seen a lot of that since, all kinds of dances, Reagan and Gorbachev, et cetera, et cetera. The dance that's going on now is a death rattle. It's a frightening thing. When you're talking about a New York Times editorial and a piece of, in the Financial Times from him, you're talking about an authoritative voice of the elite. And what frightens me is that, where I might have had in the back of my mind that Clinton and the generals that are, making policy and all those people were rogue, and that at some point the elite would step in and say, hey, you can't blow up the world we own. But it seems like this is the position of the elite, and it's frightening.
Right. That's right. And Clinton is their representative. You see what I'm saying? I mean, I'm certain to a lot of people, you and I seem to be kind of madmen. I guess people could have accused us of drinking Trump's Kool-Aid and other things, not so complimentary.
Right.
But now it is clear. I mean, and you don't need rocket science to be able to connect the dots. Clinton represents the party of war unapologetically. If she is elected, you know, we can expect the likes of a Samantha Power to be the Secretary of State.
My God.
If not a National Security Advisor or something big in the administration. In terms of foreign policy, the State Department will be organized on parallel lines to the Pentagon. In other words, it will not be about diplomacy. Even the tepid and frightened moves of John Kerry to reach some kind of peace agreement with Lavrov and Russia, all of that will be scuttled, will be kicked to the side, and it will be all-out confrontation with Russia, with Syria, with Iran, with China. You know, full-spectrum domination means 2.5 wars. China, Russia, and the half is Iran. And that's what they're looking at. So I think the left has to be awakened before it's too late. What Martin Wolf does say, and this is very important in his article, is that even if Trump does not win, the damage has been done. And it is profound. He acknowledges that tens of millions of Americans are turned off to the political and economic system. And that's his words, political and economic system. He doesn't say just the elite, the system. Right. This is a crisis of legitimacy. And, you know, it's quite interesting that he takes that line because there is another article by, you know, Martin Jacques. Martin Jacques is, you know, a really kind of famous left-thinking writer and journalist. He wrote the very influential book on China entitled When China Rules the World that came out about a decade ago. Right. And at the end of August, he writes this article called The Death of Neoliberalism and the Crisis in Western Politics. And what he says, and this parallels what Martin Jacques is saying, he's saying that 9 years after the crisis of 2008, that the West is now reaping the political whirlwind of that financial crisis.
Right.
And this is what we're seeing. And he acknowledges that this is producing a crisis of legitimacy in the West. And he says, if I could just quote him, but the causes of this political crisis, glaringly evident on both sides of the Atlantic, are much deeper than simply the financial crisis and the virtually stillborn recovery of the last decade. They go to the heart of the neoliberal project that dates from the late 70s and the political rise of Reagan and Thatcher, and embrace at its core the idea of global free market in goods, services, and capital. The Depression-era system of bank regulation was dismantled in the U.S. in the 1990s and in Britain in 1986, thereby creating the conditions for the 2008 crisis. And he goes on.
And so the political crisis was basically postponed. I mean, Obama, people weren't watching because he actually put together the Democrats on the bank bailout while Bush was still president before the election. He went in and hardballed with the leadership of the Democrats in both the House and Senate to pass that because it had failed after a record number of emails came from the population and Democrats voted it down. And so he started then, but people that didn't notice that saw him as someone who was an agent of change 8 years ago. And so, and you know, Jacques clocks this from 2007, which is why he says 9 years. But that's what happened. And so, you know, you had all the mystification of the Obama administration, but the real suffering continued through that. And now the political expression is coming to the fore.
That's right. And you know, and Martin Jacques points out in this article, on average, between 65 to 70% of households in 25 high-income economies experience stagnant or falling real incomes between 2005 and 2014. Mm-hmm. You know, if you want to understand Donald Trump, that's it. I mean, the Brits are, you know, being more honest and straightforward and saying this is not just a fly-by-night thing. This is deeply rooted in what neoliberal capitalist policies and architecture of global financial and economic relations has wrought, and the immiseration of the working class. You know, now there's another article that I was reading recently looking at global poverty. And that article, it's a research article, states that 100% of the reduction in global poverty occurred in China. In other words, it was China's anti-poverty policies that account for all of the reduction in global poverty. Mm. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So here we have it again. I mean, this is huge, what we are looking at, that the world is poorer, including the United States, than before the 2008 collapse. And we know that for 40 years, practically, wages for the majority of working people have been stagnant.
You know, and if you look at other studies that take a longer view of that, you can see that the poverty reduction that has taken place outside of China has taken place in, for example, Nicaragua, Venezuela, Brazil, Argentina, under left governments, and particularly the eradication of extreme poverty completely, more or less, in Nicaragua. A remarkable feat, by the way, given the objective conditions there. The same with Venezuela, beginning with Chavez in 1998. And so if you take a longer view, you can see that it's China and left governments in developing countries that are all more or less targets or have already been successfully targeted by the United States.
Yeah, that's right. They're countries that have rejected the neoliberal capitalist architecture. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
In a certain sense, China is riding two horses at the same time, maybe going in opposite directions.
Right.
It's a part of the World Trade Organization, but at the same time, it goes against much of what the World Trade Organization recommends for economies, because it is state-regulated capitalism. In other words, the state sector is the largest part of the Chinese economy.
Right.
So it's regulated and purposeful and more or less planned economic development.
Right.
And even in times of slowed down economic growth, you know, from 10% down to 6.5% or 7%, which is amazing, you know, still there is not the suffering and forcing the working people to pay for a crisis in financial markets and in global trade.
Yeah, so we're going to have to stop there. Professor Montero, thank you. A pleasure as always.
Thank you very much, man.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.